Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Collins Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo. Last week, we discussed the issues of race and police militarization here on the Collins Show. Prior to that program, we attempted to include a representative from local law enforcement on the panel, but we were unable to secure law enforcement participation. We thought it important, however, to gain a law enforcement perspective on the issues of race and police use of force and militarization of police. So this week, we bring you panelists who can speak from a law enforcement perspective. Joining me in studio today to discuss these issues is Paul Hay, former sergeant and 25-year veteran with the Albuquerque Police Department, or APD, who retired from the force in 2011. Joining me by phone from Georgia is Sergeant Patrick Hayes, an active member of the Varnell, Georgia Police Force. Welcome to both of you today, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Good morning, Paul, and good morning, Sergeant Hayes.
Good morning.
Yes. We'll be joined at the bottom of the hour by telephone by Norm Stamper. He is a retired Seattle, Washington police chief. Chief Stamper guided the Seattle Police Department during the time of the World Trade Organization, or WTO, protests in 1999, and he retired very shortly thereafter in 2000. Now, I do want to let listeners know that we invited the Albuquerque Police Department to join this conversation today. At one point, we were told that Joe Wolf, director of training for APD, would be joining us. But a short time later, a mere half hour, a spokeswoman for APD said that permission for his participation had been rescinded. Over the course of the past 8 months, KUNM has hosted five other call-in show discussions on issues of police use of force, the Department of Justice's investigation of APD and officer-involved shootings, law enforcement public records, and interactions between Albuquerque police and people who have mental health conditions. Each time we have invited the Albuquerque Police Department to participate in these conversations, and each time the department has either declined to participate or cited scheduling issues as a reason for not participating. We look forward to hearing from representatives of police department that serves the state's largest city. In the meantime, we will continue the conversation without them. So, Sergeant Patrick Hayes, let's start with you. I discovered you when I read your August 19th article titled "The Officer-Involved Shooting and Police Response in Ferguson, a Law Enforcement Perspective." That piece was published on the website, thetruthaboutguns.com, and I believe we have a link to that piece on our call-in show webpage, or we will later. As noted at the top of the program, we were unable to find any local active law enforcement personnel who would come on to discuss these issues. And in my research and preparation for this show, I did not see any other active officers writing about their perspectives on the Ferguson situation and policing in general. What motivates you or motivated you to write about these issues?
Well, basically, the Truth About Guns is a multifaceted website, a program website that has the technical issues, products, and explores the political issues of gun ownership. And they were covering that topic. And I, whenever I see something that does have a police perspective, I normally do a piece just to give that perspective. So I'm the only one on that site that does that. And it's usually a different point of view from the general citizens.
Does your police chief, your force, do they have any objection to you speaking out on these issues at all?
No, they haven't at this point. Basically, it's just a general opinion, and the opinions are actually mine, so they don't actually reflect the opinion of my department. They're my opinions and my perspective based on my experience.
And again, if people want to go ahead and read your most recent piece, we do have a link to that on the call-in show webpage. Sergeant Paul Hager, a retired sergeant, 25-year veteran of the Albuquerque Police Department, why are you willing to come on and discuss the issues of race and police use of force when others are not?
Well, I think it's very discouraging that the Albuquerque Police Department wouldn't have a representative after you've reached out to them. It shouldn't be me sitting here. It should be the chief of police sitting here in my place. If you're not willing to reach out to the public and explain things to the public, this is where untrust and suspicion develops. I've always said, if you're not willing to face a problem, you can't solve that problem. as everybody knows, we've made national headlines here in Albuquerque. We have problems here. And I don't see anybody stepping up to solve those problems. You know, they put Band-Aids on things here to make it look to the public like they're doing something, when actually they're doing absolutely nothing. And you look at it from a law enforcement perspective, you laugh at it. It's a joke. But the general public doesn't know that.
Well, is that your motivation then, to inform the general public at this point?
I want the general public to know what's really going on within the Albuquerque Police Department. And as I say, it shouldn't be me sitting here. It should be the chief of police sitting here.
Well, I'm glad that you're with us today, and I thank you for being here. Sergeant Hayes, you work on a small-town police force. In 2012, there were fewer than 2,000 residents of Varnell. What is the size of your Varnell, Georgia force?
It's just a handful of officers, four full-time and a few part-time. It's one of four police departments inside our county. The county has about 110,000 people. It is a small, quiet community, and that's kind of what I was getting at. Was I don't think the people in Ferguson expect this happening more than I would, but they should have had a plan, and it appears that they didn't.
All right. Now, tell me just a little more about Varnell and the surrounding area. Is the population diverse there, say, racially?
We have a basic mix of white, black, Hispanic, and several other nationalities. And in the county, it's pretty much the same all over. So it's pretty fair spread out.
Is there diversity of race and gender in the ranks of Varnell's handful of police officers on that force?
Not at the moment. We just have a few officers, and all the officers are white, which is predominantly what our city is.
Okay. Do you feel, now here's a general question, do you feel that police work, the foundations of it, are the same, whether one works in a small town or a large city?
Basically, all police officers are guided by the laws and rules of their state. They're certified by the state, and they're required to act under those rules. So the basic foundations of how it's done should be the same for any officer in any given state. Different states do it differently, but inside each state, the rules are generally the same. The problems that a large city would face may be different than a small town or small city, but generally the policing should be done the same way.
All right. Now, Paul Hay, retired sergeant of the Albuquerque Police Department, in contrast to the population of Varnell, Georgia, 2012 figures put the population of Albuquerque at greater than 100,000 residents. That's 500,000 residents. Do you feel there are some basic foundational elements of police work that are similar, regardless of the size of the force on which one works?
Oh, absolutely.
And what are those for you?
Well, basic foundations of any police department is how you act and how you enforce the state laws that you're sworn to enforce, both state and federal laws that you're sworn to enforce. There's basic training throughout the country that in certain situations, all police officers should act the same. That's why I watch things on the news when they say a police officer did this or a police officer did that, no matter where it is in the country. And I look at it from a law enforcement perspective. I go, well, that doesn't make any sense. Not saying that the police officer didn't do it, didn't make a mistake. But, you know, looking at it from a law enforcement perspective, I said, well, that doesn't make sense to me. Why would somebody do that?
Well, let's talk about training a bit to find out, just even get a sense of whether it's basically the same throughout the country or are there regional differences. It's like, for example, and let's start with you, Sergeant Hayes. What is your experience with regard to how you were trained about the use of lethal force? What general training did you receive in that area?
Okay, well, it wouldn't be general training. It'd be extensive training, and it is done every single year. Every year, police officers in Georgia have to both qualify their weapon and train on use of deadly force. This is the same training throughout the state. It's extensive, and it's probably one of the most important issues we face every day.
Is it specific about situations, I was reading somewhere there were different philosophies, whether it's an escalation of force that leads up to deadly force. Can you talk a little bit about the specifics of it?
Okay, we use what's called the use of force continuum that starts with the presence of the officer and ends with deadly force. This continuum is not straight up or down, it moves. In other words, you may go to an almost deadly force situation during an attempted burglary. And the minute the suspect's secured, you drop back down to officer presence. This is a scale. It's not a definite. You have to go from step A to step B. You can go from step A to step D and back down to step B like that.
All right. And so, Paul Hay, you were with the Albuquerque Police Department for many years. Is there a similar training regarding the use of lethal or deadly force here?
It's absolutely, positively the same. In New Mexico, and I believe it's the same across the country, the only time you can use deadly force is in the protection of your life or the protection of someone else's life when you're faced with deadly force. In other words, in New Mexico, and I believe it's the same across the country, if somebody breaks into your house and steals your TV, a police officer cannot use deadly force to stop that person. Even if the person's getting into their vehicle and going to flee the scene, and you're there as a police officer, you cannot use deadly force to stop that person. The only way you could use deadly force is if you were confronted with deadly force by that person, or that you believed in that person's flight they were going to commit deadly force on somebody else.
Are Albuquerque police trained on that same continuum?
Absolutely. Positively.
Okay. So,
I've always told my officers, once the handcuffs are on, the fight's over.
Well, you know, so when you got on the streets, and let me start with you, Paul Hay, when you got on the streets, in quotes, did your thoughts or actions about the use of lethal force change in any way from what you learned when you were trained or repeated when you were training?
No, it's ingrained in you. You learn it in the academy. Then in Albuquerque, you have to go with a training officer for an amount of time. That watches over you. It's ingrained in you. It's reinforced. It never changes.
And how about for you, Sergeant Hayes? Did when you got on the streets, did things change for you from how you've been trained, or like Paul Hay? Did you just? It's so ingrained. It's how you respond.
Paul is absolutely 100% correct. It doesn't change. It's a specific set of rules and a specific set of conditions when deadly force can be applied. It doesn't change. It's all based in constitutional law, federal law, and state law. It's in case law. That is where that's been developed, and it doesn't change. It's a specific set of circumstances.
Well, now you've written about this, so here's a question for you. If we have training for police in academies, and yearly, it appears, regarding the use of lethal or deadly force, why do situations like that with Michael Brown in Ferguson happen?
Simply because that shoot itself has to be evaluated. We don't know. We weren't there. We don't know what Mr. Brown did. We don't know what the officer did specifically. If his actions were in accordance with what he was trained and he did feel his life was threatened, then it will turn out that way. But if it turns out the other way, that he reacted wrongly, then they'll deal with that in due time. Problem was that everything erupted before that could happen.
And Paul Hay, how what's your thought about why things like the Michael Brown shooting actually occur after all this training?
Well, I agree with Sergeant Hayes 100%. We don't know what happened in Ferguson. We weren't there. All these news commentators, they're all putting in their opinions, and a lot of them are rushing to judgment of the officer. We weren't there, and they weren't there. Only the officer knows what happens, and unfortunately, the victim, Michael Brown, that can't speak for himself, knows what's happened. Officers make mistakes. I'm not saying that happened in Ferguson. Officers are human. And officers can make a mistake the same as anybody else can make a mistake. And I'm absolutely not saying that happened in Ferguson. I don't know what happened in Ferguson. But I'm just hoping that it will be a true and fair investigation. And whatever the outcome of that investigation is, we're all going to have to live with and we're all going to have to accept.
Well, so the reality is we may never know what actually happened there. But Sergeant Hayes,
we'll know. We'll know what happened.
We'll know what happened exactly in those moments before Michael Brown was shot?
Yes, we will.
All right. Because it seems like there are witness accounts that that differ?
Well, eyewitnesses are the worst evidence you can absolutely have.
Exactly.
But there's going to be forensic evidence, and that is the best evidence you can have. And there's going to be DNA, most likely, and there's going to be shell casings. Eyewitness accounts are the worst evidence that you can have.
We're talking today about police use of force, about militarization, about how race enters into the equation. I'm joined by Paul Hay, former sergeant and 25-year veteran with the Albuquerque Police Department, who retired from the force in 2011. Joining us by phone from Georgia is Sergeant Patrick Hayes, an active member of the Varnell, Georgia Police Force. If you would like to join in our discussion with present and former law enforcement personnel about these issues, there are several ways for you to participate. You may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Call In Show webpage, also at kunm.org. You may call our local number. That's 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. What questions do you have for our law enforcement personnel panelists regarding the use of lethal force or on other issues? We'd like to hear from you when we get back from this short break. Sergeant Hayes, I want to talk more with you about your article, and we'll get to your phone calls.
Support provided by New Mexico Educators Federal Credit Union, where increased member participation in their not-for-profit financial cooperative has increased benefits. For a financial calculator and member benefit details, go to nmefcu.org.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, the first of two programs about raising boys, we get three perspectives about how to steer them away from violence.
Most of these individual differences in things like violence are much more due to nurture than they are to nature.
How can we forge a healthier version of what it means to be male? And then model that for the young men that we encounter.
That's next time on Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution, Friday morning at 8 on KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Collins Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo. We're talking today about law enforcement-related issues in light of what's happened in Ferguson, Missouri. I do want to let people know that we did invite the Albuquerque Police Department to join this conversation. At one point, we were told that we would get participation, and then a mere half hour later, that participation, permission for that participation had been rescinded. Over the past 8 months, we have asked repeatedly for participation, and we either have just gotten a decline to participate or there's a scheduling conflict, and we do look forward from hearing at some point from representatives of the Albuquerque Police Department that serves the state's largest city. And in the meantime, we'll go ahead and continue our conversation with our panelists and with our callers. And Sergeant Hayes, before I get to that first phone call that's waiting here, I wanted to ask you, because again, we have a link to your article up on the website, and I'm wondering, now I've read it, but I'm going to ask you, were you able to make observations and come to conclusions about the appropriateness of Officer Darren Wilson's actions in shooting and killing Michael Brown?
No. Well, like I posted there, basically, was the facts that were out at the time I wrote the article, or the facts, or at least what they were reporting. Like Sarnay said, there's no way to know exactly what happened. Basically, the rules of deadly force apply, and if he either followed them or he didn't, that's just the way it's going to have to come out. Either his life was threatened or it wasn't. And they'll have to determine that through their investigation. They have a grand jury impaneled, and they'll have to get together all the facts and make that determination.
All right. Let's go ahead and bring in our first caller. It's Cal from Los Alamos. Good morning, Cal.
Good morning, and thank you for the show, and thanks, panel, for being here. I, too, am sorry the Albuquerque police didn't show up. My question goes to, I'd like to hear the panel's reaction to a recent book published by Radley Balco on the militarization of police departments and the overuse of SWAT teams. I mean, I don't think the public has any objection to SWAT teams being used for lethal situations, such as the Webster, New York shooter about a year or two ago. And by the way, I grew up near there. But in Balco's book, which has been covered by The Economist and elsewhere, it seems that SWAT teams are being used for routine work, such as raiding low-stakes poker games and going in with people inspecting for barbershop permits. And it seems to me that whole notion of increasing use of paramilitary force for non-lethal, non-dangerous situations is basically setting the pattern for police abuse. So I'd like to hear from the panel on what they think.
All right, Cal, thanks so much for your question this morning. And Sergeant Hayes, we were talking about this issue. And so describe for us what it's like in your part of Georgia regarding the use of SWAT teams.
In my particular county, we had what's called an SRT team, special response team, in the 90s. We no longer have that. We found that it wasn't as necessary as it was originally thought. When we do search warrants, they're executed normally by regular patrol officers who are actually equipped to do that. They still do a dynamic entry and all that, but they don't use an actual SWAT team. The Georgia State Patrol maintains those type of teams, and they're on call anytime we might need them with a vast amount of resources.
And, you know, I was telling Paul Hay, our other guest, about that situation this morning, and his question was, does a city like Atlanta have a SWAT team or no? Is that also just regional again?
Oh, no, I'm sure Atlanta does.
Okay. All right. So, Paul Hay, tell us a little bit about your response to the caller's question and comments.
Well, SWAT teams are very necessary. And even in Albuquerque, they're very, very necessary. It comes down to leadership and training and, honestly, common sense. I mean, we all know about the Gibson Guitar raid where they were going in to look for illegal wood. And they came in fully dressed in SWAT gear and carrying all their SWAT weapons and so on and so forth. Really? For a bunch of employees that are working in a factory and you're coming in to look for wood? I mean, it comes down to common sense, and it comes down to training, and it comes down to leadership. I mean, at the Gibson factory, and I keep bringing that up because I just couldn't believe it. As a police officer, when I saw it on TV, I laughed to myself. I go, this is ridiculous. I mean, a few detectives could have walked in and asked him, we want to inspect your wood, and we heard that you have illegal wood. But they come in fully dressed in SWAT regalia. It was crazy.
What are the guidelines here in Albuquerque for when a SWAT team is used?
SWAT teams are normally used here for deadly force, barricaded subjects, armed subjects, those types of situations. They can be used on search warrants, but if it's a high risk search warrant. I've done hundreds of search warrants without SWAT teams, without SWAT presence. So basically, here in Albuquerque, you'll use them for high risk entries, barricaded subjects, and things of that point.
All right, let's go ahead and bring in our next caller. It's Muni, I believe. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that, but from Albuquerque. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you to both of the officers for being here. It's really nice to be able to hear at least some law enforcement opinion or point of view, perspective. My question is regarding the continuum of force. And it begins with the officer presence and ends with deadly force. So, and I understand that deadly force is the, final level, last option, but it seems that there was very little discussion of what else is in that continuum. Because if it's simply officer presence to deadly force, then there's a huge. I understand that wasn't what you were saying, but it seems like a huge disconnect or quite a problematic approach to so many much less deadly situations.
I think, Muni, it just wasn't fleshed out. Is that what you're asking for us to do here?
That was partly it. And
okay.
Yeah, also the sort of, it seems that there's an assumption that, not, and again, I'm speaking from my own perspective and experience with police officers and situations where it escalates really rapidly. For example, about 3 weeks ago, I saw a kid who looks like one of my neighbors. I live in the university area. Being interrogated rather roughly by two officers on Silver, and it just seemed unnecessary. Like, a normal conversation would have been far more productive than the sort of And the kid kept very calmly saying, "I'm not resisting arrest. I'm not resisting at all. I just want to ask you some questions." Things like that. And it seems to happen very often.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get some comment from our panelists. Thanks so much for your call today. So, Sergeant Hayes, go ahead. If you would just sort of talk a little more about that continuum for the benefit of our listeners, please.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably where you misunderstood. It doesn't have to have those two steps. Officer's presence, verbal commands. Now, well, for example, in an arrest situation, I have to arrest somebody for a criminal offense. My presence is one, the lowest use of force. Then I would give them a verbal command, such as, "I'm placing you under arrest." If you resisted at that point, I could lay hands if I needed to. I could deploy a taser. I can, whatever force, counter his force. It goes up. We have all the stuff on our, I call additional officers, which would probably be the next step. This is the continuum. You go up and down. The continuum is necessary to affect what you have to do. It's not simply officer presence, deadly force.
Okay. All right. And, Paul Hay, the second part of Muni's comment about seeing the Albuquerque police roughly interrogate an individual on the sidewalk, does that happen a lot? I mean...
Well, I don't know what he means by roughly interrogate.
I know. He didn't elaborate about laying on of hands or what, but...
Yeah. Sergeant Hayes... nailed it in his comment. One thing people have to remember, not only the officer's presence, but you have such a thing as verbal judo, where you use your voice and your words to get people's attention. And what people have to remember is when a police officer tells you to do something, you do it, period. If he tells you to turn around and put your hands behind your back, you're going to get handcuffed, you do it. If you have a complaint, there's a time and place for that complaint at a later time to address, "I don't feel the officer should have done this. I don't think the officer had a right to do this." Well, that's what internal affairs is for, and that's what the courts are for, and that's, you have a time and place to regress your grievances. But on the street, when an officer tells you to do something, do it, period.
You're not the first officer to say that. There was a big to-do in the press about an officer in the L.A., or maybe former officer in the L.A. Times, saying the same thing. But a lot of people take issue to that. They're like, "Hey, we know our rights. We know when they're being violated. We don't like that they're being violated, and we're going to let the officer know there on the spot that they are being violated."
That's where things escalate, and that's where things go downhill. I'm not saying officers are always right. I'm not saying, officers don't make mistakes. As I said, they're human, they do. But when you're on the street and you're in a confrontation, verbal or otherwise, with an officer, you do what the officer tells you to do. There's a time and place to redress it later. And if the officer is wrong, the officer will be punished.
All right. Joining us now by phone from Seattle, Washington, is Norm Stamper, who retired as that city's police chief in 2000. Chief Stamper guided the Seattle Police Force during the World Trade Organization, or WTO, protests in 1999. He now blogs for the Huffington Post, and he is the author of Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing, published in 2006. Welcome, Chief Stamper.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Absolutely. Now, the title to an August 16th Los Angeles Times article reads, "Seattle Police Chief During WTO Unrest Appalled by Ferguson Violence." Why were you or are you appalled?
Well, because what I saw was appalling. Police officers dressed in military garb, driving military vehicles and employing military tactics early in the stages of the demonstrations in Ferguson, while they were still peace vigils, while they were nonviolent. And so I think it's important that every law enforcement agency in this country learn from the mistakes that I made in 1999.
Now, when I want to ask you a direct question, when So you wrote a book called The Top Cops, Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. When you looked at those, the response to the protests in Ferguson, did you feel there was a racial component to that response?
It was pretty hard for me not to conclude that there was a racial component. Here we are in 2014 with a law enforcement agency of 53 officers, only three of whom are African-American, policing a city with 70%, two-thirds to 70% of its population black. That alone is disturbing and raises a lot of questions about a commitment to making your police department representative of the community you serve. I think it was also, and I'll tell you what I described as appalling, that was a police officer who, on the other end of a leash that he was holding, was restraining a snarling, lunging German Shepherd. That's a white police officer with that dog facing a nonviolent crowd. Now, there's an imagery associated with that that is most disturbing. It takes us back to the 60s in this country, where Birmingham Bull Connor was unleashing police dogs as well as fire hoses against nonviolent, non-threatening demonstrators. The iconography of that, the imagery of that, is bad enough. It's also a very foolish approach to crowd control.
Now, Sergeant Hayes, you've worked there in the South. Talk a little bit, and I know you and I talked about this in preparation for the show. How the people in the South, when they saw those images, when the people you interact with, I know you can't speak for the whole South, but the people you interact, when they saw those images, what did that bring up memories of the civil rights related violence in the South for them?
It did to me. It most certainly did. That was a very heavy handed approach. And like I said, they probably didn't expect it. They didn't really have a plan. But when I saw all that, it's exactly what I thought of. When I saw them accosting journalists, I saw one scene where the journalists were actually in a line of fire and had to be quickly evacuated. It was a total disorganized thing. And like I said, what it did is escalated the situation, especially when you have people from outside the Ferguson community coming in to protest. Our job is to de-escalate conflict, not to escalate it. I think they jumped in with the big guns too quick.
All right. Before I get to our next caller, we did have a question from the web. And just to clarify this, if we can do this briefly, Paul Hay, you said that eyewitness accounts are the worst, and I heard Sergeant Hayes agree with you. Why? Aren't they heavily weighted in court? And if you can do that briefly.
No, they're not so much heavily weighted. I'll just use a quick example. Working an accident scene, ask people, did you see what happened? Oh, yeah, absolutely. This blue car that smashed into this red car. Oh, you saw it? Yeah, I heard him crash, and then I looked over. Oh, you heard him crash, and then you looked over. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you know what? The accident's already over, you know. And then and eyewitnesses can change. They think they see things that they don't see. Your mind plays tricks on you. You can use eyewitness statements, and you can lead. They can lead you towards gathering other evidence. But people's mind, you know, their brain plays tricks on them.
All right, and people may want a more in-depth answer, but I do encourage them to engage with us on the comments sections. Let's go ahead and move on to a call here, Robert from Cedar Crest. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. How are you? First of all, I want to thank your guests for being willing to appear. The only way a dialogue occurs in this kind of situation is when people can and are willing to hear each other out, and so their willingness to be there is impressive. My question concerns whether there's a culture change in police departments that accept equipment and training under DOD's Excess Property Program. In other words, does the status of officers involved in community policing decline relative to those who become involved in the SWAT training and that type of unit?
All right, let's go ahead and get our panelists to comment on that. So Chief Stamper, let's get you first, and the caller is referring, Robert is referring to that 1033 program. We know New Mexico in particular is the seventh on the list for having received equipment from the DOD. But his question is there a culture change that happens when that equipment, just by the acceptance of that equipment?
I believe there is. We were well on our way toward establishing some pretty good models of community policing in various parts of the country before 9/11. Now, I think we need to go back to the advent of the drug war, the acquisition of military-grade equipment from the federal government in support of the drug war. That was creeping along kind of incrementally. And then suddenly, an explosion of activity in the wake of 9/11. Now, no one argues against Homeland Security. Everyone argues for preparedness. But if what you're preparing for is not at all consistent with the reality that you're facing in your home jurisdiction, there are tiny police departments in rural parts of America that have acquired millions of dollars worth of military surplus. So that has to affect the workplace culture. Whether it's sitting in a field across from police headquarters rusting out, or it is being used on low-level, nonviolent, pre-dawn drug raids or other kinds of situations that really don't demand that kind of entry on the service, for example, of a search warrant. So it does affect us. If we dress police officers like soldiers, if we equip them like soldiers, if we train them like soldiers, guess what? I mean, they become soldiers rather than peacekeepers.
Well, and let me go ahead and ask Paul Hay. He's retired from the Albuquerque Police Department in 2011 as a sergeant after 25 years there. When you saw Albuquerque begin to accept this equipment, did you see a culture change in the police department?
No, I didn't. It all comes down to training, training, and more training. Common sense and when to use the equipment. I am thoroughly convinced that the United States is going to be hit again by terrorists. And, of course, everybody knows it can't happen here in Albuquerque. It would never happen here in Albuquerque. Your police department is your first line of defense, not your Army, not your Navy, not your Marine Corps. It's your first line of defense. And you better have the equipment ready to use it when it is necessary and when it needs to be used.
All right, let's get Sergeant Hayes, just a brief response to what Paul Hay just had to say.
Okay, basically, like you said, it's training and deployment. The chiefs, the captains, they decide the level of response, whether they call in all the heavy guns or whether they use patrol officers. It's basically the policies of leadership. Who decides what's going to be used when and how to train the officers? You know, like I said, we have very little of that equipment here. Some places have a lot of it.
Okay. Let's go ahead and bring in our couple of callers. They want to discuss the Albuquerque Police Department not being here. Let's bring in Tom from Albuquerque. Good morning, Tom.
Thank you, Kathy. Thank you for your guests, too. And I want to reiterate what was said at the top and perhaps expand the parameters that it's absolutely indicative of the city leadership in the mayor's office and at APD that they never in a public forum will address the public. That's why grassroots organizations in this town had to go to the DOJ to get relief from the death squads that patrol our streets because the mayor would not address the council or grassroots organizations that were petitioning him for change. And to widen this bigger discussion about militarized police, unique to New Mexico, is the fact that we are a military state. Three Air Force bases, one right here in town. This Air Force base has been serving the public by poisoning the water table in Albuquerque since the 1960s.
All right.
Just as there is no accountability for military terrorism, we have no accountability for police terrorism either.
All right, Tom, thanks so much for your call today. We do have to get to a short break, but before we do, I do want to let our listeners know that we did invite the Albuquerque Police Department to join this conversation today. We invited them to join last week with regards to today's show. At one point, we were told that Joe Wolf, Director of Training for APD, would be joining us, but a mere half hour later, a spokeswoman for APD said permission for his participation has been rescinded. We have had five other call-in shows over the last 8 months with regard to police-related issues in which we've invited APD to participate, and each time the department has either declined to participate or cited scheduling issues as a reason for not participating. We do look forward in the future. We are still hopeful to have representatives of the police department that serves this state's largest city. In the meantime, we will continue the conversation without them and with you. I do want to let you know that if you'd like to join in our discussion with present and former law enforcement personnel, there are several ways for you to participate. You may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may call our local number, 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. We'll be back with your phone calls and more discussion with our panelists when we return from this short break.
Stop in and see English Green Wall, the painting donated to KUNM by internationally collected artist Paulo Klein Uber, Saturday, September 6th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Jewish Community Center in Albuquerque. The painting is valued at $20,000. See for yourself why his work is in collections worldwide. Enjoy refreshments from Seasons. Raffle tickets will be available. That's Saturday, September 6th, 6:30 p.m. at the Jewish Community Center, 5520 Wyoming Northeast.
On the next American Radio Works documentary, schools across the country are trying new ways to teach based on brain science. Teachers say current techniques are failing.
We call that drill and kill. We'll just keep drilling you until we kill you, and then you will definitely hate math.
New approaches help students learn more deeply.
There's an aha moment. Oh, I know how to do that.
Listen for The Science of Smart from APM, American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and today we're having part two of our discussion regarding current events in Ferguson and elsewhere on race and police use of force and militarization. I'm joined by Paul Hay, former sergeant and 25-year veteran with the Albuquerque Police Department, by Sergeant Patrick Hayes, an active member of the Varnell, Georgia Police Force, and by Norm Stamper, the retired Seattle, Washington police chief who guided that department during the time of the World Trade Organization protests in 1999, and we welcome your participation. Let's go ahead to a caller, Judith from Albuquerque. Good morning, Judith.
Good morning. Thank you for your programs, plural. My question is, who tends to benefit? And basically, I'm looking at manufacturers and corporations that go ahead and start making noodles of money, taxpayer money, on first providing for our military, and that's being pulled back. So therefore, they've got to find another avenue to sell their product.
Well, let's go ahead and just get a brief comment on that from sure. From Chief Stamper. Is that a discussion that needs to be had?
I'm not sure that it does, frankly. I think it is important, obviously, to look at motive and why we do things. But I think when you're equipping an army, when you're equipping the military to fight a war, you don't want to shortchange the soldiers. You don't want to compromise the mission. So the provision of this military equipment to soldiers makes infinite good sense. It also makes good sense under a very carefully restricted and very well-regulated system of provision of this military and military-grade equipment to local law enforcement. I agree with the other panelists. There is a time, a place, and certainly occasions when military equipment, military weaponry, and military tactics make infinite good sense. I was present in the wake. I was a police officer in San Diego for 28 years. 6 years in Seattle. So for a combined total of 34 years, I will never forget what I saw on a summer day back in 1984 in San Ysidro, which is a community of San Diego next to the Mexican border. There you would find a McDonald's that was invaded by James Huberty, who was armed to the teeth and who had opened fire on children, moms, dads. He had killed 20 people before one of our SWAT snipers was able to take him out. In the wake of that carnage, I asked myself, our SWAT officers asked themselves, could we have gotten to him earlier? Could we have actually saved lives? We'll never know for sure, but what if we had had an armored personnel carrier that we could drive up to the door or even through the door to take him out earlier? It makes infinite good sense when you've got a Columbine, a Sandy Hook, a McDonald's massacre, or any of these other mass shooting incidents, active shooter incidents, to send in exactly that kind of equipment. And very well, your other guests have repeated this, and I'll just echo it, very well trained, very well disciplined, very well led police officers.
Well, and certainly those kind of events, Chief Stamper, are horrific, and yet they don't occur very often. So perhaps the issue is with deploying those vehicles in the appropriate situations, not necessarily having them.
Well, that's absolutely true. Having them means you need to maintain them. Having them means you need to train personnel in their use. And the less frequently you're called upon to put that kind of equipment, technology, and weaponry into place, the greater the justification for training exercises, for simulations. I think it's when we routinize the use of that equipment, when we call it out in larger jurisdictions, for example, a couple of times a week or maybe more often, using them on low-risk, nonviolent, non-threatening drug offenders, for example, in those pre-dawn raids, we're setting the stage for tragedy. And we need to recognize that there is a time and a place, and we need to honor the criteria that we establish.
Well, we certainly know that Seattle has that equipment, and Albuquerque. Sergeant Hayes, has Varnell, Georgia, accepted equipment from the DOD under that 1033 program?
We have. I managed it. It was before my time with the department. It was in the early 90s. A lot of folks don't realize this program has been around for a long time. And something I think that the caller mentioned needs to be clarified. A lot of people don't realize this stuff is on loan, the majority of it, from the federal government. Any rifles, pistols like that still belong to the federal government. They're on loan, and they're at no cost. It's not like manufacturers are now selling it to us.
Okay. All right. That is a good clarification. Let's go ahead and bring in our next caller. It's Jonathan from Albuquerque. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning. I wanted to thank the panelists for being here this morning, and I thank you guys for allowing me to give my opinion, or at least a question. my question is referring to the emotional and psychological stress that the officers are under on the job, and then would that have... I mean, what is your opinion on the effect on those judgments that the lethal or even non-lethal judgments under those psychological and emotional stresses? And does the department have steps in their organization to address these emotional and psychological stresses? I'm not sure in what way that would be, but. That's my question.
All right. Thank you so much, Jonathan. And we talked a little bit about this last week. And so address that, if you would, Paul Hay, as an ex-member of the Albuquerque Police Department.
Well, I'm thoroughly convinced that any police officer that's been on the job for any amount of time has PTSD. I know that I have it. I went to an American Legion seminar and on PTSD, and when they explained about it, I said, man, I got most all of those symptoms. And so I'm certainly not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but I did speak to the ones there. And I said, I think I have most of these symptoms. And they said, what'd you do for a living? I said, well, I was a police officer for nearly 25 years here in Albuquerque, but over 30 years. And they all said well, we'd be amazed if you didn't have it. The carnage you witness, the situations that you're in, the terror that you can experience, and you do experience. Police work is, you know, 8 hours of complete boredom and, you know, 30 seconds of complete terror. So it would be amazing that you didn't have it. And APD does have resources that you can go to address if you feel you're having problems. Many officers, unfortunately, don't take advantage of that because they don't want their fellow officers, who should probably be going to,
also, right,
to know they're going,
right,
or judge them. Yeah.
Let's go ahead and bring in our last caller. It's going to be Eric from Albuquerque, and we'll use this question as a way to sort of wrap up and get comments from everyone here on the panel. So, Eric, good morning, and briefly, if you can make your comment or your question.
Yeah, my question is basically the same concerns that the gentleman had earlier about the lack of involvement or the lack of dissemination of information from the city of Albuquerque or any police force. So I would like to pose that in the question. How important is it to disseminate information from the mayor, the CAO, or the police department to the citizens? I just think I ask this question because I feel that the police officers are taking all the political bullets on the streets, and administration is kind of getting away with not being held accountable, and there seems to be a concentrated effort not to release information. And I would like to have the host of the show answer that first, being a journalist, and how that would affect her role.
Well, I'm going to the way it affects my role is very simple. I don't get to create balanced panels most of the time, and that is very frustrating. But I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. Let's go to our panelists. We have a former Seattle police chief. And so just to address quickly, because we are running out of time, when there is that lack of availability from the administration to discuss issues, what does that engender?
I think it all begins with a basic premise. The police in America belong to the people, not the other way around. And everything that a police department does should reinforce the notion that the police are a part of, not apart from, the community. Now, beyond the rhetoric, I think there is a critical responsibility on the part of police administrations to recognize that our departments do the public's business. The public has a right to know. The public needs to know what you're thinking and the reasoning behind your policies and your procedures. Now, I want to add one comment to this issue of stress because I think it's terribly important, and I agree with the other panelists on this issue. But there's also stress that is caused organizationally. And there are too many police departments, in my opinion, who treat their frontline professionals like dependent or delinquent children and then expect them to behave as mature and respected adults. Mm. Life just doesn't work that way. We need to be treating one another within the organization with dignity and respect and encouraging open communication.
All right. And you can hear our closing music underneath. I do want to ask you, Sergeant Hayes, just one word answer. Should our police chief here in Albuquerque be out talking to the public here?
Most certainly.
And Paul Hay, briefly?
Absolutely, positively. It's appalling that he's not.
All right. Well,
it's actually vital.
It's vital. Okay. Well, we'll hope to get him on. Thanks to our guest, retired 25-year APD veteran Sergeant Paul Hay, former Seattle, Washington Police Chief Norm Stamper, and Sergeant Patrick Hayes of the Varnell, Georgia Police Department. Thank you, all of you, for speaking out on these issues, for making yourselves available to our listeners. Thanks to our callers for helping to develop our discussion today. Thanks to our engineer, Jefferson White. Kaveh Movahed is our assistant producer. Michael Hess has handled our phones today. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Kathleen Sabo. This has been the KUNM Call-In Show on 89.9 KUNM and KUNM.org, a public service of the University of New Mexico.